Hi, this is Willie Wilson. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. Host Teresa Wilkie talks with Lauren Stanton of the Northeast Kansas Brady Campaign about the Castle Doctrine that allows a homeowner to use deadly force against an intruder and its many interpretations and variations in the laws of our area. Today, host Keith Washburn talks with author Archie Williams about his book, The Evolution of Africans in North America. They will discuss the effects of chattel slavery in the past and the virtual slavery of today, as well as potential solutions to the traumas of the past and present. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now to Teresa and her guest.
Good morning. Thanks for listening. I'm going to call this program Appropriate Defense in the Time of the Right to Bear and Use Arms. That's my kind of sardonic joke. We have Lauren Stanton, who's president of the Northeast Kansas Brady Project. Welcome, Lauren. Thank you for coming on air.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a few words about the history of the Brady Project. Who is Brady? What happened to Brady?
Well, it goes back to the assassination attempt on President Reagan. Jim Brady was the press secretary at that time.
And, 1981.
Yeah, way back in 1981. And there were four injuries in addition to the president and Mr. Brady. There was an FBI agent, I believe it was, or maybe it was Secret Service, and a policeman. The most severely wounded was Mr. Brady, and he was shot in the head and had lifelong issues because of that. But in the wake of that, he and his wife, Sarah, gathered together and began to work on this issue and eventually turned a smaller organization into the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, and they've been engaged vigorously in this issue ever since. The big accomplishment legislatively was a Brady law that gave us background checks on gun sales.
Commonly known as the Brady Bill, passed by President Clinton in 1993.
Right.
And that is a federal law that requires background checks for persons buying guns from licensed firearm dealers,
right,
correct?
Only licensed dealers, right.
But at the time, that was a huge change.
It was. And it's been the most major, there hasn't been a more major lasting piece of federal legislation on guns since then, unfortunately.
Well, let's talk about the status of gun laws now. It seems to me, as I'm just an observer, I read the newspaper, gun laws have been increasingly liberalized despite increased mass and senseless shootings. We have self-defense or stand-your-ground laws, and defense of one's property or the Castle Doctrine are active defenses for harms caused by the use of guns. So what are your goals now, the Brady Center?
The National Brady Campaign has identified three issues that it's emphasizing, that it believes that if we do those three things, that would at least be a huge start in the priority items on a national level. And there have been and are bills in Congress. One is to expand that background checks law so it includes all sales. And then there's the ban on assault weapons, which, of course, that is the terrible weapon of choice in all of these almost all of these mass murder events that take place. And the third one is adoption of extreme risk protection orders, or popularly called red flag laws, that allow a family and law enforcement to go before a court and ask for temporary removal of weapons from individual who can be shown in court to be a danger either to themselves and or others.
All right, Lauren, that is terrific. We're going to slow down on those three points of the Brady Project platform. Now, recent news, U.S. News reported October 29th, that there has been a first-of-its-kind survey done by a medical group that found that 11 of every 100,000 children and teens treated in United States emergency rooms have gun-related injuries. And that amounts to about 8,300 children a year. And the money that is spent is almost $3 billion. This is a cost of almost $3 billion. Hmm. And the scope of the problem is broader because the study doesn't include kids killed or injured by gunshots that never made it to the hospital. And it doesn't count costs for gunshot patients after they're sent home. So we see an increasing problem with the number of guns and the use of guns. And so let's turn back to your first point about the expanded Brady background check for all gun sales. And the Brady bill said there's a background check, and this is a criminal, it's an NCIS, National Criminal Institute of Safety.
Right. There's this online file that dealers access that has the backgrounds on people to indicate whether or not they are felons or have serious mental health issues, or there's a variety of things that can disqualify people to have a gun.
So, excuse me, if anyone goes into a gun shop, a licensed firearm dealer, and purchases a gun, the dealer is required to run this background check.
Right.
However, there has become a huge loophole in gun sales, buying guns at a place of a gun show, and internet sales. And so the Brady campaign would like that protection of background checks to be expanded to all gun sales.
Absolutely.
Including those at gun shows.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And you go to a gun show and most dealers there who are selling are licensed dealers, but there also are unlicensed dealers. And so guns can be bought without a background check there. And over the internet, if you order a gun over the internet and it is mailed to you, it has to go to a dealer actually to run a check. But there are a lot of sales too that escape that check. If you just on the internet find there's a gun for sale, you can meet somebody, you can buy the gun, and there's no requirement to have that check done. Anywhere from the numbers are really hard to pin down just exactly. Anywhere from 25% to 40% of all gun sales are not checked. So that's an awful lot of guns that are changing hands with people, and we don't know who they are. And far too many guns are falling into the hands of people who are dangerous.
So I found some numbers on that. Between 1994 and 2010, this is after the passage of the Brady Bill, an average of 343 prohibited purchasers were blocked from buying guns every day. And a 2016 study found that more than 90% of Americans support expanding Brady background checks to all gun sales, including more than 80% of gun owners.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is a friendly idea that people are generally in support of, wouldn't you
yeah.
say?
Yeah, the polls indicate that people, as you said, are strongly behind it, and the numbers you cited prove over and again how well this works. And yet, you know, I go to the Kansas legislature, talk to legislators who will oppose these for whatever reason, and the reason often given is, well, the bad guys are going to get a gun one way or another regardless. But this proves that your background checks stop those people. Now, maybe ultimately a lot of them find a gun elsewhere, but it is one way. If it was universal, it'd be even harder.
In other words, they don't have a good defense. They
they
don't give a logical response.
Maybe I'm a little biased.
Why this is a bad idea. Let's go to your second, which has got a similar objection. Banning assault weapons and all high-capacity magazines. So shooters and massacres such as Parkland, Las Vegas, Orlando, Sutherland Springs, Aurora, and Sandy Hook have all used assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. These weapons of war do not belong on our streets. That's the belief of the Brady campaign, correct?
Correct.
So bills have been introduced in our federal Congress, the Keep Americans Safe Act, that says there should be restriction on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Do you want to talk to us about that platform?
Well, yeah. I don't know the exact wording and set nature of that bill, but yeah, the essence of it is to ban most of those guns of that size in that class, because, as you say, that is the weapon of choice for mass murderers. These are weapons of war. There's really no need for such a weapon to be sold publicly. I understand that a lot of people enjoy the recreational kick of them, but I think you need to find another way to enjoy shooting a gun than with these things. I think anybody who has had the awful experience of being involved in one of these shootings or witnessing them and seeing the aftermath, seeing the slaughter and that happens, especially in places like Sandy Hook, it's sickening, and it can be stopped. It could greatly reduce, of course, even if there's a mass shooting, it at least reduce the number of people who are killed.
I apologize to you listeners. We don't have an opportunity to take phone calls today, and I know that you're wishing you could call. I know I can hear you clearly saying what a sad and terrible thing to deal with the advent of assault weapons on the street. One of the unstated platforms, an earlier tenet of the Brady campaign, is that gun safety is paramount to having a gun. An assault weapon fires so quickly. The Keep Americans Safe Act is defining that as a device that can feed more than 10 rounds of ammunition into firearms, automatically feed more than 10 rounds. Mm-hmm. So once upon a time, when you had a handgun or a rifle that only made one shot, and people that are trained on gun safety, they realize they point their weapon, they put their target in the scope, bam, they shoot. Now you point your weapon, you put your target in the scope, and then all of a sudden you can shoot 10 times without the corresponding amount of time to think about your act, to think about what you're doing. One pull of the trigger will rip off 10 rounds.
Yeah.
High-capacity magazines are not as safe.
Yeah, and we get hung up sometimes in some kind of semantic battles about, well, what is really an assault weapon and what is automatic or semi-automatic. But the simple fact is these guns have a powerful force. They can be fired very rapidly, and they can increase the toll of mayhem that happens when somebody uses one to attack a group of people.
Without any thought, they don't have time to think about what they're doing. They just shoot.
Yeah. Obviously, there's not much thinking going on. You're right.
Okay, so I did find some statistics on this current proposed bill, Keep Americans Safe. And it has 27 co-sponsors right now in our federal Congress and no Republicans. They're all Democratic sponsors. It was introduced by Feinstein, a Democrat from California. It's referred to the House Judiciary Committee. Lauren, let's go to your third platform. Pass Extreme Risk Protection Order, ERPO laws. Okay, you right. Easy call those red flag laws. You want to tell our listeners what is a red flag law?
Yeah, as I mentioned, and by the way, there was one introduced in Kansas last year. Didn't get a hearing, but hopefully it will be back. I mentioned a little bit earlier about this law that it allows if you have a family member or someone you know who is displaying some troubling behaviors that you're afraid that they're going to hurt themselves or someone else, you can, usually people would, with the help of law enforcement, because they may have been brought into this situation or been made aware of it already, go before a court, a judge, and explain the situation and appeal to them to allow for the temporary removal. It depends on the bill as to how long temporary might be, but usually it's around a year. And it allows for that temporary removal of any and all weapons from that individual. And there's a chance for appeal if this person's situation changes for the better. And so it gets that gun out of the hands of the person, and sometimes it's a suicide situation or the threat thereof. A lot of times political people, after these mass shootings, even the ones who are really anti any form of gun control, say, well, we need to do something about mental health. But this is one way to get at that problem. If family and law enforcement can point out that somebody is having some emotional and mental distress, this gives one avenue to get that away until this person gets some treatment, counseling, whatever. And in most cases, and indeed, the gun is restored later to the owner. I mean, this isn't a permanent removal. There's the appeal process. They demonstrate that this person is safe once again to have their gun back. So it's not some clever way to start taking guns away from everybody. It's just in those cases where we're trying to take a protection order,
just like what
right,
it's called.
Right, right.
Yeah. So statutes like this exist in California, Oregon, Washington State, and Connecticut. And it would be, if you think it would be good to have them in our states, ask your candidates for office, research their stance on these ERPO laws or extreme risk protection orders. And these apply
Absolutely.
To family members, not friends.
Right. That's my understanding. And again, that's the bills I've seen. That's what it has been, is family members. Right. But there may be a ERPO law that's been written that'd be broader than that. But I'm not sure about that.
So, also in the news in the middle of October, U.S. News reported that there's a Gallup poll that the majority of Americans oppose a ban on semi-automatic weapons. And yet, in the same article, there's a Gallup poll that shows the majority of Americans believe in stricter gun control measures. So, I try to map out the news to understand our country's stance on guns. And it seems clear to me that people have the right to buy and own a gun, and people should be licensed to have a gun. And we would like to believe that licensing is a process of learning gun safety. Is this true? Is this the status quo?
No, I mean, there's no licensing. There's no that kind of responsible law. It's just the kind that we've been missing. Another in Kansas, in Missouri, I think Missouri has done this again. My apologies. I'm a Kansas side guy, but I think Missouri also has done away with any training to carry concealed weapons. There used to be, certainly in Kansas, until about 2 or 3 years ago, a requirement that you go through 8 hours of training and to learn when you can and can't use that weapon. You learn the legal limitations and so forth. You demonstrate that you can actually shoot a gun with some degree of accuracy. But those kinds of things we have lost. And You would think. I mean, that's what so much of what the Brady campaign is about, is promoting greater responsibility and safety at all levels, from the manufacturer of the guns to the selling of the gun, and then on the part of the gun owners.
So, what the numbers show us from the polls, it goes back and forth. Some people really believe that there should be no restrictions on guns, and others believe there should be restrictions on guns, and it's just about 50-50, in fact.
And when there's a horrible shooting incident, the polls shift one way, and then they kind of go back the other way,
So now then, the Brady Project's position, there's a new campaign, Keep Home Safe from Guns.
Yeah, it's the exact name is End Family Fire, but it is an emphasis on safe storage of weapons at home, and it's a very new program, and our chapter hopes to get involved in trying to provide just educational information and whatever we can to emphasize why it is so important to keep guns saved, stored safely, especially if there are ever children around in the home, because accidents certainly are a great issue. There are, in this country, there are 8 children a day who are shot in the home with guns that are loaded and unattended. And so a lot of education has to go on. I realize most gun owners out there, especially if they have kids, are responsible about locking up guns and things, but far too many are not. And even those who think they're being safe and careful sometimes aren't. They will hide a gun where they don't think a child would ever find it. And kids find stuff. And this has been shown over and over again. And there's been a lot of tragic stories where that has happened. So this is an attempt to spread that word about how widespread this is and how many homes that exist where there are where kids. There are 4.6 million kids that live in homes with access to unlocked and unsupervised guns. And 3 out of 5 kids ages 5 to 14 know where those guns are kept in the home. So that's a bad mix of these guns available and these curious kids who seek these things out.
Right. Listeners, Lauren is looking at me like a grown-up curious kid, and certainly as I sit here, I knew where my folks hid things too, so we understand exactly how children behave. Now, take a minute to give us the Brady Campaign's contact information, would you please?
BradyCampaign.org is the national site. There's a lot of information on the issue there. We have a Facebook page in Northeast Kansas Brady Campaign Facebook. You can find that. So there's good information there. There's also affiliated with that program I mentioned earlier is another program called Asking Saves Kids. I won't get into the details of that, but it also has information about keeping kids safe, and it's called AskingSavesKids.org. And that is a joint project of the Brady Campaign and the American Academy of Pediatrics.
People, if you're interested on which of the candidates that are available to vote for have what their position is on safer gun ordinance, the Brady National website gives a candidate endorsement. And so it lists by state people in the federal House and people in the state legislatures that are in support of these laws that are currently in the hopper that can help to keep guns appropriately used.
Right. Our local chapters don't endorse candidates, but the national does, and so that's the place to find it. Yeah.
This program has contained the views and opinions of the host and her guest and does not necessarily represent the opinion of KKFI 90.1 FM, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, or their staffs, boards, sponsors, and volunteers.
Now the calendar for the week of November 5th. Youth Ambassadors invite you to attend The Things We Face, their annual community event where youth share powerful readings from their journals. You can join them Thursday, November 8th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Unity on the Plaza, 707 West 47th Street, KCMO. Take time to listen to voices that have no megaphone. Open to the Sky, a poetry reading by former and present inmates from Lansing Correctional Facility, will be held Thursday, November 8th, 6:30 p.m. at the Interurban Art House, 8001 Newton Street, Overland Park, Kansas. This is an Arts in Prison presentation. Corey's Network invites survivors of murder to their weekly workshops to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop, not a grief group. You should bring something to take notes with, and please include only those individuals mature enough to deal with the issues. The next workshop, How to Deal with the Media, will be held Monday, November 5th, and again November 12th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, KCMO. The church is located east of the Hy-Vee at 40 Highway and Nolan Road. For more information and listing of future workshops, call 816-834-9161 or email Corey's Network@gmail.com. Mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, November 10th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineers today, Keith Washburn and Mike Murphy. Up next is Keith Washburn.
All right, welcome back to Jaws of Justice. I'm Keith Washburn. My guest this morning, our guest is Archie Williams, a frequent guest here on KKFI. We used to have him on the Khadija and the White Guy show. You've been on several times. And he's written a book, which is entitled The Evolution of Africans in North America, a fascinating book. Welcome, Mr. Williams.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So we've gotten to know each other a little bit over the last couple of years.
Yes, we have.
And you're a regular at Eggs and Enlightenment.
Too regular, but yeah.
I want to say hello to all of our friends at Eggs and Enlightenment. And also, Mr. Williams comes over now and then to the Joe Louis Maddox group, which, you know, Joe Louis went to heaven, but we're still carrying on in his name over at the Southeast Library, second and fourth Thursdays.
He was a great inspiration of mine, Mr. Maddox. Matter of fact, he would keep telling me, Williams, you got to get published. So, Joe, I hope you're looking down so I can show you that I did follow through.
He did it. He absolutely did it. And I got to say, I'm impressed with anybody who can write a book and get it published. So the book is a good book. Some would call it a great book. And, you know, I've got a copy of it here in my hand. And for those of you that don't know, Archie Williams is a master's level social worker who has worked in the field of social services for over four decades. So he's worked with a lot of youth, particularly African-American youth, right?
That's correct.
And the book, you know, which is, again, The Evolution of Africans in North America. So you know a little bit about this because you have several years of experience being an African-American yourself.
Yeah, just a couple.
Now that you're
like
over 40.
60-something odd years.
Okay. Yeah. So why did you write the book?
I wrote the book because being an African in America and not really having that direct association with Africa and watching, I grew up, I'm a baby of the civil rights movement of the 60s, and that was a awakening time to grow up as a young man, a teenager, and see all the events taking place right before your very eyes. And I did know segregation, but I didn't know why. And with the civil rights movement and pointing out that we were second-class citizens and in this country that professes that all men are created equal raised a question. But what really got me was after watching the 67 riots in Newark, Detroit, 65 in L.A. out in Watts, and then in, what was that, 92 with the verdict of the officers getting off from beating severely.
The L.A., Los Angeles.
Rodney King beating. And then watching the results of that, still more riots. And it seemed like we were going backwards as a people. I'd witnessed the riots, and then I'd in the 60s, and I witnessed the 70s and the 80s, Jesse Jackson running for president. It seemed like there was progress going on, but yet again, we were at a point to where we were taken to the streets in rebellion. So I wondered why. So I became very acquainted with, this is before Google and the internet and all that, the Kansas City Public Library, where I spent an awful lot of time researching our history in America, why are things the way they are today? And that's what got it started back in 1993. And I compiled some information. I'm not a researcher. I wasn't at that time. I was a family man, raising a family, working 8-hour job every day, but still very curious. Now, my work was working with youth in various programs. I worked at Ozenam Home for a number of years as a youth counselor there, supervisor. I worked for the state of Missouri in their youth programs. But I had seen how therapy, how you address an obvious behavioral problem by not just reacting to the behavior itself, but there's always a cause for behavior. And it was the search for the cause of behavior of my people so that we can make sustainable progress and it be lasting. It's what drove me into the libraries. And what I found was pretty remarkable. There was an old saying. I went to college, and one of the professors used to have this joke that I didn't think too much of back then. This is way back in 72. But he would say, you know, the best way, Williams, to keep a secret from a black man, put it in a book.
Ah.
And I hated that comment then, but it was while I was in the library reading about the progression of the history that shaped Africans in America, I figured that he was right. It wasn't a real secret, but it was because you don't pick up a book and read the information in it, then it is a secret to you. But that's how I got to writing the book. I had it on a floppy disk. Now, this is back in the 90s, and the person who typed it up for me had a business. Well, that person went out of business. I lost the floppy disk. I couldn't find that person, so all I had was a hard copy. And in my efforts to put the book together in my later years, I started out with a company, a self-publishing company, whose name I'm not going to mention because I wasn't real happy with their services. But I do appreciate that I do have a book in front of me now, but what I had to go through, it took me several years of working with them to get the book to where it is now. The quality of it isn't what I wanted, but what was critical to me was getting the message out. The people I was identifying for writing this book were, or still is, the average African American, particularly the young people who haven't been thoroughly indoctrinated with the falsehoods of racism and demeaning images of who they supposedly are and descend from. I want to be the generation where we stop the momentum, the perpetuation of that. You know, the physics states that emotion, that an object set in motion will remain in motion until met with an equal or greater force. So I'm hoping that this book will meet the force of perpetuating this lie of a colored, a Negro, will be able to end with the awakening of some of the information in this book.
Yeah, the book has some great facts in it that I was not aware of. So, as you say, you did your research, you know, and whatever that man told you, he probably didn't mean it for good, but you used it to motivate you to get into the library and actually just call out several facts that people just don't generally know. So, and you said before, your hope is that the audience will be a lot of younger people.
Exactly.
Actually change the way things, change the momentum here, and, you know, turn things around with this book and maybe others also.
Yes, nothing defeats a lie but the truth. And a lot of what we are taught in schools, in the public education system here in America, is not predicated on the full truth. It's said, too, that if you leave out certain facts to a truth, then what facts you do allow is still a lie because you're not telling the full information, you're not giving the full truth. So this, I hope, sheds some light on some of the full truth. It's not a pretty truth, but it is the truth. And we can't begin to heal unless we address these events with the full truth. And the whole intent behind this is to heal. You know, we can't keep, and I'm not just talking about African Americans specifically, in this illness there are two parties. The one who initiated the illness, being the white plantation owners at the time, who later became the founding fathers, all the way up to everyone who has continued the ideal of white supremacy and using race and racism as a tool to maintain white supremacy. They have to heal from that, as well as we African Americans who are dealing with the oppression that white supremacy initiates and maintains.
Right. Well, you and I definitely agree that teaching the correct history, we talked about this at the Joe Louis Maddox Group on Thursday, you know, teaching the correct factual history, even though it is grievous, let's say, at the very least, right?
Right.
Is the only way to go. And, you know, some might ask, and by the way, I want to get back into the book here in a minute, but some might ask, you know, well, you know, do we really have to go back there and go through all that? And again, you and I agree that, you know, you got to get the truth out there, right?
Exactly.
So how much time, I know it's difficult to say, but how much time in a school, you know, when you're going to school, you're learning history and so forth, how much time should be spent on phase one, which you identify, of course, as, you know, the when we brought people over on the ships from Africa,
right.
You know, up until 1865, I believe, is what you identify as phase one, right?
That's when, exactly. I got it marked out from 1662 and all the way up to 1865. And the problem with learning this fact is we're talking about a lot of events taking place over a large span of time. So to make it coherent, you have to take a lot of those facts, and you take the most significant ones that illustrates how one leads into the other to make it plain for folks. Phase one is the critical point because it gives you a view of the initiation of this problem. The first 20 Africans that arrived in the Jamestown colony, which was a British colony in 1619, were not slaves. The labor source were indentured. You work a set amount of time, generally 7 years, and then you would regain your freedom. So it wasn't a perpetual, permanent form of slavery at
right.
that time, and it wasn't just Africans.
And a lot of people may not be aware of that. And I want to say that I want people to go out and read the book. Go out and buy the book so you can find out what he's talking about, because this is some of the facts that I didn't know about slavery and how it started, how it gradually became a permanent, you know, just basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, it became permanent property ownership as opposed to the way that it started. It's fascinating, and that's in the book. By the way, we didn't say how folks can get the book.
Well, you could go online to Amazon.com and type in the title of the book or my name, and you can purchase it online. Or for a while, my website, I believe, still is up, just my full name in one word, ArchieJWilliams.com, and my web page should come up. Or you can email me at ArchieW44@gmail.com, and I'll make sure I can get a book in your hand.
And, you know, you can also catch Archie speaking around town as he did over at our group, the Joe Louis Maddox Group. Catch him down at Eggs and Enlightenment on Friday mornings.
Every right? Friday.
At McDonald's over at about 15th and Prospect. Is that about the right address?
That's pretty close. It's the McDonald's right off of I-70 between the I-70 and Prospect, just
right.
North of Prospect.
Catch him there on Friday mornings. But getting back to my question, which is, you know, if we divided it up into the three phases, and again, we're not going to have time to go through these three phases and so forth, but generally it's up until 1865, then the period from 1865 to 1947, I believe. Is that right?
No, from 65 up to 1964 is phase two.
Okay. And then the phase three he calls, I love this, heal thyself, which is then up until current day. So how much time in our history, when we're talking with both white and black youth, because I think white kids should be taught the history too, how much time should be spent on phase one, percentage-wise, if we're saying 100% in history class, phase one, two, and three? What do you think?
How much time? Time as it takes, actually.
Well, what I mean is, percentage-wise, would we say like 40% should be spent on phase one and then 30 and 30? Or should there be more of an emphasis on phase one?
Well, I hadn't broken it down like that, but definitely you have to understand phase one in order to understand the following phases, because phase one is where the whole structure of things got rolling. Phase one is... it goes before the founding of this country, so there's quite a bit of information to understand. But it continues, and how it continues and by whom is critical to understand. Phase one didn't end. It took a civil war for phase one to end. But the interesting thing is that after phase one, when bondage was ended, that phase two was followed by maintaining the personality and identity that was bred into the Africans in phase one. And you use hegemony to do that through laws and customs. We had separate but equal, you'll find in phase two, which better known as the Jim Crow laws. Well, it gives you a better understanding of why those laws came about and what purpose it served in phase two. Those laws existed by my demarcation up until the writing of the Civil Rights Bill, the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. And that bill did away with any discrimination. It sort of finished what the Brown decision had started in 54. So those are the external legal control that shaped and maintain an identity and an attitude in this society involving African Americans and their role. Phase three since 64, with those external laws removed, but still the damage done with the breeding and then the sustaining of the laws, and two, is still existing within African Americans as well as white population and how we view each other. So it's the elimination, the healing ourselves of that is where we're at now.
So let's talk for a moment, because we've just got about 8 minutes left, and I'm trying to be cognizant of the time. By the way, you're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on 99.1. I'm sorry, that's 90.1. I should know my own radio station, right? KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We're talking with Archie Williams about his book, The Evolution of Africans in North America. And so now let's talk, if we can, for a moment about solutions. What are solutions for white folks? What are solutions for black folks to make this happen, to make the healing happen in America?
Well, as I'm retired, by the way, after 40-some-odd years in social services. I retired a year and a half ago. But what I learned as being a therapist is that in order to heal, you have to know and understand fully and accept what it is you're healing from. So having a good understanding, absent of any emotions, because this is a very touchy thing. When we talk race, there are lots of connotations that come up in different people's minds about it, and some folks want it to just go away, but it obviously haven't. So the first thing is to take a hard, critical look, devoid of any emotions as much as possible, and look at what caused it, what role did who play and what and why. Not for the point of trying to find revenge, but trying to find resolution. There's an African proverb that states one cannot expect to be healed from his sickness until he's able to face what is making him sick. And in this case, American slavery is a source of what is ailing us that we haven't resolved yet as a nation. So that's the first part. Now, the roles that you play, and in therapy, you will identify specific tasks that people involved with the healing or the treatment have to pick their own path for cure based on their part in the whole situation. And with African Americans, it's up to us to identify what's been placed in us, this lack of actual identity, ancestral identity, and to begin to reconnect with who we were before there was America, the great civilizations of Africa, the great people we actually descend from, rather than only identifying descending from slaves. That's a negative that people fight against as far as broader European Americans have to get over this whole issue of white supremacy. And it's going to be difficult because there are certain privileges that goes along with that. So there'll be a task for them to address that, no, I'm not superior, and here's why I think I am, and I need to get to the truth of the matter so that we all can exist in peace.
Somebody once told me, whenever you ask somebody to give something up, that's when the trouble is going to start.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge. You're right about that.
So in treatment, you go through different phases to arrive at the cure.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Let's talk a little bit, since tomorrow is Election Day. So I call it Trump's racist rhetoric. That's what I would personally call it. And again, mm-hmm. You're listening to our opinions, Archie and me, not so much the opinions of KKFI or Midcoast Radio. So I'm calling it Trump's racist rhetoric, which is amazing that nobody has stopped it yet, so to speak. In other words, there's a certain number of people who are going along with it. And the most amazing thing to me is that there are quite a few African Americans who approve of Trump as a president. How many is up for debate? Trump says 40%. And I went
out and
looked.
That's a lie.
Yeah, I went out and looked, and there is a poll that was published, I think, on USA Today that says 36%. And then NAACP says 21%. Well, personally, I am shocked that it would even be as high as 21%.
No.
But that's a number from the NAACP. So what do we do? What do we do as a people who disagree with this kind of racist rhetoric? What can people do about it? How are we going to turn this around?
Well, that's a very deep question that has a real simple answer. I mentioned earlier that racism was started for a purpose, and it was a tool that's used, and it's used by people who are in power, the 1% who set up this economic system. Donald Trump is a part of that system, and he's very consciously using race as a tool to divide. That's what racism is for. Those who are in power know that as long as they keep the populace divided, then little attention will be given to the exploitation that's taken place over all of us. So race is used as that tool to keep us at a disadvantage, keep us divided amongst each other, while the 1%ers benefit from keeping an economic system in place that benefits them. Until we as a people stop and realize that, when you look at Trump's base, as they're called, these are people that have been disaffected in American politics for a long time, and they felt like the advances made by African Americans was taking away some of their rights, and there's a whole lot of psychology that goes into that and why they support Trump so ardently. But until we understand that Trump is a con man, I can't diagnose him, but he certainly has some of the characteristics of an antisocial personality disordered individual. And if one would look that up and see the criteria that sustains that, then they would see a lot of Trump's behavior and it'd be more clear to them. So we're being played, in other words, and we mean black Americans, white Americans, and everything in between by those 1%ers in keeping this craziness, this illogical racist idea moving. So that's why the deep question that you asked and the simple answer would be for all of us to pause for a moment and take an honest look at who's in control, how they're maintaining their control, and then you'll see who's benefiting from all this chaos. Someone is benefiting, and if we take time to pause and look at it, we can identify who, and then that's where the power comes in, we the people.
I love the way you said it. You said we're being played.
Exactly.
By our president. So that's pretty accurate, at least in my opinion.
Well, the system, our president is just a tool of the system itself, too, so we understand that.
So tell them again where they can get your book. It's called The Evolution of Africans in North America by Archie J. Williams, the Three Phases of Permanent Perpetual Slavery. And where can they get it?
You can go online to archiejwilliams.com and order a book there. You can email me at archiew44@gmail.com and give me your information. I can get a book to you, or you can
do it online at Amazon.
Do it online, right? At Amazon.com. Thank you.
And you mentioned also to me earlier this week that you're going to be speaking, and tell them where that's going to be. Didn't you say it was toward the end of the year, I think?
Well, I'm going to be at the American Jazz Museum on Dr. King's holiday, where I'm a student of Dr. King, and I've been asked to recite some of his most important speeches. And during the week of Kwanzaa, now, Kwanzaa, it starts the day after Christmas, and it goes all the way up to New Year's, and it's a cultural celebration, not a religious ceremony. There's folks who get it confused, but we have a whole week down at the Gym Theater, 7 o'clock in the evening, where we celebrate our culture and history. I'm planning on selling some books there.
Right on. So, Archie J. Williams, thank you again for being on Jaws of Justice, and I want to again mention he's going to be at Kwanzaa down at the Gym Theater, 26th through
January 1st.
January 1st, so you can catch him there. You can catch him at Eggs and Enlightenment up at McDonald's on a Friday morning. And really appreciate you coming on. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you again. Thanks for listening to Jaws of Justice. I'm Keith Washburn. Up next is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
My name is Colin Dwyer. I'm at the Opioid Crisis Response Fund. I am a fiscal sponsee of the Harm Reduction Coalition, so that means I kind of operate as a subsidiary of theirs. I'm a grantee of a number of philanthropic foundations and major donors. And I'm basically a startup fund raising money for the sake of funding community-based organizations that are engaged in naloxone distribution where they can't get money, you know, in other ways. Like they can't get money from, from the federal government or their county health department. And if it wasn't, I'm out there trying to basically get money for people who are trying to pay for naloxone with yard sales or Facebook fundraisers or something like that. You know, there's a lot of money out in the world to buy naloxone, and that money, the people who decide who gets that money are sometimes getting that money to people who can't really use the naloxone to get it to the places where it's going to be most likely to be used to actually do something about an overdose. So there's millions of dollars out there to buy naloxone, but it's going to, you know, elementary schools or maybe local law enforcement or places where it's popular to fund naloxone distribution. But unfortunately, you know, getting money to, you know, community organizations that actually work with people who use drugs, who are actually the people who are most likely to die of an opioid related overdose, it's not as popular to give money to those kinds of organizations as it is to a school. So I'm trying to correct that problem and going out to raise money to try to take care of that. Yeah.
But am I right, though? It's not that cheap per dose.
It depends on what you are trying to buy. So there's an auto injector device, which is very expensive, right? The regular Narcan that most people know, if you're trying to buy it over the counter at the pharmacy, I think it'd be $125. Right, but the actual generic intramuscular naloxone, which is, you know, effective and appropriate to use and safe to use, it is not expensive enough that anybody should not be able to have it to save. I mean, there's probably, I mean, I'm not a public health researcher, but when I tell people you know, how much it costs to save a human life in the United States with naloxone. People thought, like, I thought you could only save money, save lives that cheaply in Africa. You know, it kind of shows that we really actually don't value human lives equally in the United States when, you know, Medicare spends $34,000 per capita for end of life care. You know, whereas, you know, somebody could be alive by Monday if we had naloxone in the right hands.
I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.